For our other survey question, a lot of y'all, it was a little bit of a trick question, but most of y'all were on to us because, you know, actually, you're going to have the most information, the most data about a site, a munition site, after the remedial action occurs. You know, at that point in time is really when your conceptual site model becomes an actual site model. And so really kind of thinking about it, you know, we need to be measuring that, our actual site model at the end of remedial action, you know, against our predefined, our acceptable end state. And it'd be a great idea, you know, if we start structuring our decisions to be able to capitalize upon that additional data that's available at the end of the remedial action. So anyway, just a thought, and yes, I believe we'll be touching on that during the last presentation of the day, during Nick Stolte's presentation. So just want to do a quick little summary of those. But getting back to moving on with the webinar then, good day to everybody, and always, and as always, you know, thank you, Gene. I mean, it is great to hear your voice again. And I want to be sure to welcome everyone to the fourth and final M2S2 webinar of 2016. You know, on a side note, we are in the planning stages for 2017 webinars, so please stay tuned. You know, today's session is oriented towards the remedial and removal actions and the decisions that drive those. And kind of like Francois and Inspector Clouseau's exchange here, on any given munitions project, you know, we've spent a lot of time and money figuring out what kind of bombs are present and where they might be located. But, you know, ultimately, what we want to address with our remedial removal actions are the explosive hazards. You know, we've been doing the M2S2 webinars for several years now. I think we've done 20 or so of them. And during that time, I think there's only two that I haven't been available to organize and orchestrate. And one of those was the last session back on August 4th. So I want to be sure and give a big shout out to Mike Adam with EPA Clue-In and John Jackson with the Range Support Center for stepping up and taking care of that webinar. I did manage to pull up the August 4th session in the archive and watch it, and they did a really excellent job. But as I was watching the archive, I was kind of reminded of the story of Wally Pipp. And not a lot of people know about Wally Pipp unless you're a hardcore baseball fan. Back in 1925, Wally, he was the starting first baseman for the New York Yankees. And this is actually a picture of Wally. Now, you know, Wally, he was a very good player. I mean, he led the American League in home runs for a couple of years. And the story goes that in the middle of the 1925 season, right before a game, the Yankees manager overheard Wally complaining about a headache and asking for an aspirin. And so the manager piped up and told him, Wally, you know, why don't you just take the day off and rest up? We'll try out that new kid at first base today. Well, 2,130 games later, Wally Pipp was still waiting to get his starting job back from a guy named Lou Gehrig. So after sitting out the last M2S2 webinar, I was determined to get my starting position back and not get Wally pipped by that John Jackson kid. However, him or some other whippersnapper is going to get another shot at it, because this is going to be my last M2S2 webinar. I'm going to be leaving federal service and planning to retire at the end of January. It's been a good run, but I think it's time to make room for someone else. Now, Halloween, you know, I mean, we had the theme music and everything, and Halloween is just a few days away, and since it is absolutely the best unofficial holiday, I had to work it into my slides somehow. So my cousin, he's a professional graphic artist, and this is one of his designs. He said he was trying to create something that's supposed to be funny and friendly, but it's actually kind of scary. And so when I saw this, I said, Jim, I've got to use that. And with the recent rash of creepy clown sightings and a creepy clown with a bomb, I mean, oh my goodness, that's got M2S2 webinar material written all over it. We've got a good webinar, I think, scheduled today. We have Jeff Laurie and Jeff Swanson, Greg Vann, John Baptiste and Nick Stulte. They're the speakers, so they're going to be dishing out the treats for everyone. But lurking in the background, you know, we've got Troy Fersh with the Omaha Design Center. And many thanks to Troy for pulling the session speakers together, along with John Sykes and Gene Ballant and me. Just a very brief look here at today's agenda, the items we're going to be covering today. And then also a quick reminder that if you've got a munitions project that's stuck in the mud, we've got quite a few webinars in the CLIO archives that might be helpful in getting you unstuck and back on the road. And then here at Halloween, Los Geofísicos de los Muertos, they want to remind everyone to be mindful of our explosive safety message to the public. We've got our recognize, retreat, and report. And so with that, I'm going to be turning it over to our first speaker today. Our first speaker is Jeff Laurie. He's a geologist from Arizona. He's been working for the Corps now for 7 years or so. He's an environmental project manager, and before that, he worked in private industry as a geologist for a number of years. So, Jeff, I hope that you are ready to take it away for us.
I am, Dwayne. Can you hear me?
Yes, you are coming through loud and clear.
All right. Well, you surprised me by saying that you're retiring, so I just want to thank you for all the knowledge and expertise you've shared with me over the years.
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, I wish you good luck. You're inspiring, and that I get to see people actually retire from a job. And thanks for all the work you've done for the engineer regiment and the nation.
Thank you.
All right. So without further ado, my program is called Making the Decision. We've been working on different processes to come up with decision makings, and what I focused on as an engineer officer in the Army and a DA civilian is the military decision-making process. And if you ever get interested and decide to look at it, just Google MDMP and you'll see that the processes we use in FUDs and in MMRP projects is very similar to what the military does when you create decisions and missions. So definitions. I wanted to define what we're talking about here, and these were the three critical ones I thought. The decision is a choice made from the available alternatives, right? You don't get to add alternatives if you can't make them exist. So you have to, sometimes you only get three, sometimes you get two, and maybe they're not that good, but you still have to make a decision. Decision making is this process of identifying these problems and opportunities to resolve them. So this is the critical part for project managers. In problem framing, this is how you decide what the different problems are that stop you from getting to the desired end state. And the desired end state is really closure on these sites. That's what we're trying to do. We're trying to clean the sites to acceptable risk levels and close the sites. And we can't do that without the entire team. So the project manager's role, I think the project manager, I'm sorry, let me click that. The project manager's role, our job is to lead the PDT. That's it. We have to keep focus on what the goal of the project is. And that goal is the desired end state. The project manager is required to make many decisions through a project. We've all worked with people who had difficulty with that. That's your main job as the PM. The most important decisions, I think, that you make as a project manager are who to put on the team to begin with. And I do want to thank, there are several members of my team, including contractor, customer, core experts, and regulator on this call right now. So I want to thank you guys for being part of the team that makes success. So getting the right people on the team, and you can choose the internal team members. You can sometimes choose your contractor. You cannot choose the regulator. And you cannot choose the public or the landowner or those kind of things. So you make the decisions that you can to get the people who are the best at working together. Please note that I did not say that the project manager's role was to be the technical expert. I'm a registered geologist. I do not place myself in the position as the geologist on my team. I hire another geologist from within the Corps to fill that role so I can concentrate on the goal, on achieving the closure. Okay, so George Patton, I only quoted him once in this, but he has a lot of good quotes about teamwork and pushing authority down to the lowest level. I'll let you guys read this. It really gets to the harmony of the project team. Nobody can do this alone. There is a really strong interdependence. And when I say project team, I don't mean just the core employees and the contractor. I mean the regulator or regulators in many cases. I mean the outside public who is interested, the landholders. Sometimes we deal with claim holders. All those people are members of the PDT. Some have different levels of standing, but if you don't include all of them, you're not going to be successful. So this all feeds into defining what is the acceptable end state of this. What is your desired end state? You can't get there without input from everybody. Leading the PDT. Yeah, these are personal experiences that I've had and things that I've observed. Avoid getting dragged into debates or discussions about hypothetical scenarios. We've all been in those meetings, not even PDT meetings. I mean, you can end up in a staff meeting, and people are bringing up all the hypotheticals. Well, what if a comet hits tomorrow? Or what if we find one type of bomb out there that nobody expected on the site? Oh, those are hypotheticals. We have to deal with science and regulation in our jobs. So when you're developing these acceptable end states, the hypotheticals really can't be part of that. Those may occur, but there has to be some basis in fact or regulation for us to really consider that. Otherwise, you get bogged down in things that you can't solve. If you create problems that are unsolvable, then you'll never be successful. Some of the other key things is the right people, and I mentioned this before. Coordinating with property owners, other agencies, even agencies that aren't the property holders, if they're bordering the property or they have usage through the property or they have the property is a buffer to them, it's important to talk to them early. This interaction, sometimes you want to go on somebody's property and they won't answer the ROE. I've knocked on doors before. That's the kind of stuff that you have to do to get projects done. This is really important with mining claims we've run into on several projects. We've invited the claim holders down to talk to us, to meet on the site. So getting all these people involved makes life a lot easier on you. And then the number one goal in leadership is to enable your team. If, you know, General Flowers had something that said, if it's legal, moral, and ethical, and you're willing to take responsibility for the decision, just do it. I try to apply that to life, especially within managing projects. You want your team to make decisions that they think are good decisions for the project. Here's some keys to success. Now, these all came directly out of the MDMP, which is the military decision-making process. They are very well aligned with success in project management of any type, and particularly in project management involving explosive hazards or other MMRP hazards. So coordination, always the key. That is really our main job. Flexibility. You can't be so locked down on an idea that you don't accept other people's views. Clear, concise mission and intent statements. This is how you define the acceptable end states, right? Never start a project without knowing what you're looking for at the end. For us, it's always end-I. We're looking for no further action at some point. Now, we may not find it at that phase, but we may. That's a decision you have to make. Centralized planning. So you plan it together, and then decentralized execution. You allow the people in the field to make the decisions to execute successfully. You empower the people that are on the team to make a decision and come up with ideas on how this is working. Timeliness. Our money has time limits on it. The people who give us ROEs don't like it if we're out there late or if we don't show up when we say we will. Regulators like to have a time frame, and they like us to meet that time frame because they're going to tell the public about it. And then also the contractor has a limited time on the contract. And then good decisions. Obviously, it's important to make good decisions. And I think those decisions have to be made always in the context of regulation and science. Keys to success. Here's another quote that I thought was great, and I just substituted staff officer for PM because, in my view, having lived both lives, military officers are essentially project managers. You're responsible to execute a mission that somebody else designed and gave you the end state for, and you have limited resources, you have a environment that exists that you may not be able to control, and you have a time frame that somebody else set for you. So this comes down to the timeliness in a lot of ways, and the good decisions is you don't have to have a perfect work plan to get a good project. You have to have a well-worded, proper work plan that meets the regulation and science, but you need to be able to get that done in time to actually execute your project. Okay, why do people struggle with decision making? I know this is a struggle because I've observed it. We've all had problems making decisions on something or another at one time or another. So these are why it's challenging. You're presented with conflicting points of view. There's changing conditions. Unclear information. This is especially true for a lot of the FUDS projects that we deal with because the land has been out of the inventory for 30 years or more. The sites, some of them have been used, have been out of the inventory since World War I or World War II. They've been used for multiple other things. So it's trying to make decisions based on this kind of foggy environment is a challenge. But it's important that we do it because otherwise you never get anything done. So the two types of decisions that are identified in all the management resources is programmed and non-programmed decisions. Programmed decisions are pretty easy. They're routine or repetitive. Those are ones that are defined by regulation, or they are defined in CERCLA, and they tell you, if you have this risk, then you move on. That's an easy decision to make. That doesn't take any effort. The difficult decisions to make, or the more difficult decisions to make, are non-program decisions. These are decisions that come up in a PDT meeting or in a conference call or in a response from a comment that you have to make a choice about. Now, I suggest when you're making those choices, you engage all the people in your team. I hear some chatter on the line there. So somebody on the line needs to mute their line, please. Okay, so the levels of decision making, these are the programmed are made at the lowest level. Non-programmed technically come up. So programmed would also be made in the field by somebody, the SUCSO or the OESS. They can make those decisions because they already have it laid out. They have something in the work plan that tells them, if this, then this. Okay, so I have a few exercises in here, and I developed these when I thought people could answer questions. But these are examples of actual projects, so I'll just lead you through it, and you can look at it and think about it. Okay, there's a 3,000-acre MRF with approximately 98% owned by the state. Do you need to go on individual homeowners' properties along the perimeter to get a valid model of what the site looks like? In this condition, the perimeter of the site on one side of the site is about 60 feet of it, so it's probably less than 2%. About 60 feet of it is in subdivisions in people's backyards. Nowhere near where the targets were on the sites. Very barely on there. Could be even an error in the GIS because it's old data. You know, a map line on something of this scale could be 60 feet. So what RPDT discussed and determined was that to get, this is for an RIFS, to get an accurate statistical model, we did not need to cover those sites. Now, what does that do for us? One, it takes a lot of complication out of the project getting ROEs because there were hundreds of homes that backed up to this site. Two, it accelerates the schedule because, as you know, getting hundreds of ROEs to go in there is very difficult. So we accelerate our schedule. We have one property owner to deal with. We have a really good statistical model being developed based on that 98% coverage. And we don't have to bother these people, and you don't scare people too. That's the other thing is once you go into individual homeowners and you start saying, hey, you might have a problem, we need to come on your property, you can affect their property values. You can do a lot of things that will really upset the people. And you wear them out if you go back and forth with them. If the statistical model shows that we need to go back and do cleanup, then we'll get ROE and we'll go in there and check those sites. Next exercise. This is a 500-plus acre site used for cattle grazing. Some dry land placer mining, so there's several. There's a lessee that has the cattle grazing rights. There are several miners that have mining claims on the site. So it's a practice bombing range. One of the things I didn't mention on here is this site also had some excluded areas because the state land department would not give us ROE without paying a fee, and we could not do that based on CERCLA regulation. So that's where the regulation comes into play. The RI finds a very small amount of HE frag and two craters on this site. Everything else is exactly what we expected with NOMAC, just practice bomb cases and MD. What sort of recommendations should we present? You know, that was one of the discussions we had. Should this site move forward to a cleanup phase? Well, we're looking for unacceptable risk. We did calculations based on the amount of frag found and the craters identified and the identified use of the property and defined that based on the amount of MD from the HE bomb, so the frag, we have found the craters that would exist on that site. So our statistical analysis of the frag identified that there should be no other bombs on that site because we found exactly as much as you would expect based on all the studies. So the RI report is going to present information stating that we should be done and we're going to end-eye the site at this point. Another one, 200-acre site adjacent to an artillery range is investigated for MMRP. Large amounts of MD are found at the corner of the site, and decreasing density proportionally with distance from the corner. NOMAC is found. The RI recommends an FS. Was this the right decision? Well, this is a site that I know some of the people on the phone know about. This site is a peripheral to a range. It is not part of the range of an artillery range. There is NOMAC. The MD is all frag, and since we have these ISOPAC maps showing density decreasing away, we negotiated to come in and do additional transects to prove that, to increase the reliability of the data to say that we can make a end-eye decision on this site without going to an FS. We're in the process of doing that right now. acceptable end states. This is something that the organizers of this conference really wanted me to push in my program, and so that's why I've been talking about leadership and decision making. Is this is what you're trying to get to. This acceptable end state is taking the place of the Mecca. This is being used to define, and this is a military thing as well. This is when you get orders in the military, you have acceptable end states. Like, here's what the mission requires. These are essentially if-then statements. And if you reach a certain standard, or if you do a certain thing, then you can make this decision. And you discuss these up front. These are determined by the PDT, usually through a lot of coordination. And they're developed in the RI and expanded, and they're included in the FS and the proposed plan. And then the decision document also copies these in there. It is critical to have PDT and stakeholder involvement in the development of these. And by stakeholder, I mean everybody else who cares about this site, especially the regulators. If the regulators don't like your acceptable end state, you're never going to get a document approved. And I've been lucky that all the regulators I deal with like to be part of the team as much as I like to have them on the team. So the next two slides, I'm going to apologize right now because they're pretty jumbled and tight, but they're mostly there for your reference later. Defining the acceptable end states. There are no regulatory guidelines promulgated that specify acceptable risk level associated with UXO. We have decided to make agreed upon acceptable end states as part of our project documents, and we determine what that is going to be. So each one of these end states is developed for protection of human health and the environment for the site, and it's based on the current conceptual site model. This is a critical path item. It ultimately comes down to protection of human health and the environment. That is our buzzword or buzz phrase on everything that we deal with. The acceptable end states correspond to the intent of the remedial action objectives as presented. Now, this has some leftover documentation in it because I pulled this literally from a decision document. During the development of the proposed plan, each alternative is evaluated. And we do that in table form in our documents, and then we also include it in written form. So the next sheet is acceptable end state examples from this decision document. And this was a decision document in Arizona at Fort Huachuca. I will read one or two just so you get the idea of what we're looking at. Okay, so the acceptable end state number one, if the physical search for UX performed over 100% of the MRS and the vertical CSM for all recovered UXOs within the reliable detection depth ranges for each specific munitions type, then the likelihood of a potential UXO encounter is negligible. Based on the post-remediation data analysis, the end state may achieve UUUE. So there we're defining what does UUUE look like? What conditions do we have to meet that we've all agreed upon to get UUUE? That's pretty good. Now, at the opposite end of the spectrum, we have if the previous acceptable end state 5, if the previous investigations indicate that a likelihood of UXO remains is negligible, but MD has been recovered at the site in a quantity distribution such that no potential target areas are suspected, then user behavior modification is required. Sorry, that's not opposite. This is what we're doing on this site. It is required to achieve a low likelihood a user would be seriously injured during a potential UXO encounter. So this is what occurred at this site, actually. We chose acceptable state 5 because there's possibly UXO on the site, but we really didn't find anything in a quantity or distribution that we think that there's going to be a target area that would have remaining UXO. So we're putting up signs, education, and there's a restricted entry into the site, so people have to see that. So those, you can read through those. The CX hands out this document if you need a copy of it for anything. Okay, so this is the end of my presentation, and making the decision, that's what we get down to. Remain unbiased. That is a key thing. If you go into a project with a predetermined idea of what the end's going to look like without listening to everybody's input and understanding the conditions of the site, you're not going to be very successful, especially if you're at the RIFS phase, because the SIs are very cursory information. You're not getting the same level of information that you will out of the RI. Listen to the PDT and stakeholders. And I cannot emphasize this enough. It's easy as a project manager to try to drive the project so hard that you run over people on the PDT or stakeholders, and that only works so far as until you need them to concur. So you got to listen to what their interests are in the project and what their concerns are. And sometimes you'll run across people with extreme knowledge of the site that really help you out. List the advantages and disadvantages as you find of what your decisions are. When you get to the decision about, say, reducing the size of the site by keeping 100 separate private properties out of it, the advantages, you go faster. The disadvantages, you lose data. And you got to make a decision on whether that still gives you a good project. Continually assess feasibility, acceptability, and suitability. You always got to look at that. Avoid drawing premature conclusions. This goes into the unbiased. You just can't decide until you have the data. And compare options during the comparison process, not after the decision is made. Once you make a decision, if it follows regulation and science, don't second guess it all the time, because you will not be able to close the site. Once you make a decision that's based in science and regulation and your PDT agrees with you, you have to work to get closure on that. Then my final thought, I love Winston Churchill as well as Patton, so it's no use saying we are doing our best. You've got to succeed in doing what is necessary. I think Yoda had one that was, do or do not, there is no try. That's all kind of zen. With that, we'll open the floor to questions. I know that I can't hear you, but you can email things in, and I'll go on mute for a minute. Thank you very much.
Very good, Jeff. I appreciate the presentation. I thought you did a great job with several things that stood out to me. First of all, I loved the Winston Churchill and Patton and Yoda. That's what a great trio there of superheroes to quote. That was pretty awesome. And I got to say, I also loved your next to last slide about your takeaway messages. That was really, really good. One thing that I wanted to ask was the investment in time of developing your acceptable end states. I mean, obviously that takes some work to put together and come to some consensus on. But, have you found that to be a beneficial approach, that investment in time on the front end? Does that pay off on the tail end?
Yeah, Dwayne, thank you. Absolutely. I'm a firm believer that the more time you spend in the planning and getting people to agree early on what is a smart decision for the project, and especially the acceptable end states, it's time well spent. You save more time getting in early with people and understanding each other and what the goals are and defining what the end goal is. If you wait until after you have all the information on a site to start making decisions, you'll never close a site. So it's really good to get together with the regulators and everybody and define it. And most of the people doing these things have had a lot of experience doing them. I mean, I don't think there are very many sites out there that are 100% unique that somebody hasn't seen something similar. So you have an idea of what the regulation allows you, what your scientific capacity is as far as your information and your data gathering, and what the regulator is going to agree to, and what is good for human health and the environment. I mean, it's not just about agreeing to it. Is it the right choice? So it, defining all those things early is really important.
Okay. Very good. Well, again, great presentation. Very much appreciate it, Jeff. And we're going to move on now. It's time to move on to our next speaker. If you have questions for our speakers, you know, we'll try to get to them during the session. But if not, then we have we have some time at the end of the webinar to try to address them. And our next speaker is Jeff Swanson, and Jeff's a regulator with the Colorado Department of Public Health and the Environment. And Jeff has been an iconic figure within the munitions community for a number of years, a long time. And Jeff is one of those people that, sharp guy, and to be frank about it, he pushes us on the USACE end of things, which is good, which is really good. So anyway, it's a pleasure to have Jeff here. And so Jeff, give us your regulator's perspective.
Good morning, everyone. As Duane said, my name is Jeff Swanson. I'm the UXO Staff Authority for Colorado. And in that role, I'm responsible for munitions cleanup decisions throughout the state. Today, I'm going to give you my my perspective on munitions investigations with an overall goal of making a good cleanup decision. In traditional environmental work, we use a baseline risk assessment and numerical standards like MCLs to guide the cleanup decisions. As you all know, for munitions, we don't have promulgated cleanup standards or even a risk assessment protocol. There's no consensus on how to measure munitions risk or what acceptable risk levels might be. Without those promulgated standards or other acceptable risk levels, what should be the basis for making these cleanup decisions? For that matter, what is a good cleanup decision, and how can we get there from here? Today I'm going to present a framework that I've used for myself and am encouraging project teams to use in considering to support both the scoping of an RIFS and the making of site-specific cleanup decisions. For lack of a better term, I'm referring to this framework as a munitions cleanup matrix. But before I dive into that cleanup matrix, I want to take a little time to share some of my thoughts on the role of the RIFS in getting to a cleanup decision. For many of you, this is going to be very common sense, nothing new. Please humor me. I'll get to more details on the cleanup matrix shortly. To quickly summarize my takeaways from today, first, utilize the flexibility of the RIFS process. It's actually very flexible. It's intended to be iterative. In going through it, keep the focus on the reason for doing the RIFS, and that's to get to a good cleanup decision. It's not enough just to check the boxes in the RIFS and move along. The RIFS is really just the beginning of the process. The goal of the munitions response program is to address munitions hazards, as I said before, and close sites out. The cleanup decision is a critical step, but it's just that first step. It's not just enough to figure out the site, understand the conceptual site model, and make a good cleanup decision. You've also got to clean the site up and make the site protective. It's also critical that that cleanup be accepted by the community and eventually leads to site closeout. So a good cleanup decision is one that's both protective and implementable and acceptable by the community. So what's a cleanup matrix? It's a tool or framework that I've come up with for a project team to use in coming to use as a common guide or a starting point in making those decisions. The intent is that the cleanup teams develop the cleanup decision matrix during the RI scoping process and use that matrix as a point of departure for cleanup decisions as you go through the RIFS process. The cleanup team can, and in many circumstances, should actually deviate from what they've originally come up with within that cleanup matrix. To deviate, you just have to present a rational case to support why you would deviate. Therefore, outliers and other situations like that that come up can be logically and transparently addressed. Again, the goal of the Munitions Response Program is to address mech hazards and close out sites. So what is a good cleanup decision and how does it fit into that? Well, good cleanup decision is critical to starting that, but again, it's just that first step. You also have to make sure that you've got community and regulatory acceptance and buy-in. You've also got to make sure that that cleanup decision is something that's implementable both in the short term and long term, and that it's something that will eventually lead to closing out the site, because at the end of the day, we're really looking at how do we get these sites closed out and done. I consider a good cleanup decision to have three components. It's protective, it's accepted by the community, and it's implementable. That means the decision is safe for both current and future land users, it has buy-in, and ultimately you can lead to site closeout. What's the role of the RIFS in this whole process? In CERCLA, as we know, the RIFS is the bridge between site identification, the archive search reports, the PASIs, those things, and remedy selection, and ultimately cleanup, getting between the PASI and the proposed plan ROD and RDRA. the remedial investigation is the foundation for which the cleanup decision is made. While the RIFS isn't the formal cleanup decision, it does provide the basis for remedy selection and supports the formal cleanup decision. With that in mind, for practical purposes, the project team really develops the cleanup decision during the RIFS. So from my perspective, as a state regulator, during the RIFS process, that's where we're actually developing those cleanup decisions. Now, it's true, and any lawyer will tell you that that project team decision is formalized in the proposed plan and the record of decision, but for practical purposes, it's really made at the RIFS level. So what are some of the keys to a successful RIFS? That's interesting. Duane, I just
got a... Don't
worry, we'll
get I'll get your content back up. Don't worry, we'll have it right back up on the screen in just one moment, if you'll bear with me.
I will just continue on. Does everybody else have the content?
No, somebody clicked the wrong button. We're going to bring it right back up there, though, and it should come back to where you left off, hopefully.
Keys to a successful RFS. To me, the first key to initial to the successful RFS is initial scoping. Not just scoping of the field investigation approach, but also scoping of likely cleanup options. As early in the as possible in the project, get the project team together, identify what the likely response scenarios are, where the decision points are, and what data is needed to support those decisions. Getting that common understanding of the site drivers for scoping and design of the investigation is important. You need to be able to answer some basic questions. for example, how will areas be delineated? What areas are likely to require mech removal actions? Why or why not? But also, how much data do you need to support that cleanup decision? What data do you need to get to no further action? What data might trigger a complete rethinking of the site? Talk through those scoping things early to make sure that your RIFS is your investigation part is focused on collecting the right data. Understand know the facts, assumptions, and uncertainty. Understand the basis for your conceptual site model. Stay focused on the facts. It's really important, and I think it got touched on earlier, to separate factual data, like historical range maps or incident reports, from hypothesis, which you're trying to either prove or disprove, and assumptions. For example, coming in with the assumption that, well, no one would have ever done that during training. How many times have we come in with that type of a bias and found out that, well, actually they did at this site? So ask yourself, what's my true understanding of the site based on? Is it based on hard facts, assumptions, professional opinions, hopes, dreams? Sometimes it's a wild ass guess, but it's a starting point. Understand what biases you bring to your site. Where's the uncertainty? Where are the knowledge gaps? Couple of things I have to throw in anytime I'm talking about RIFSs. always beware of statistics. If you're using statistics on your site, fully understand the statistical statements and the assumptions and uncertainty underneath those. And be cautious anytime anyone makes pronouncements about MEC. The RI should focus on evidence of munitions hazards, munitions debris, and other evidence of likely MEC hazards. Don't get caught up in what I call the lucky MEC game. When you go out and you're collecting data on a site, think to yourself, whether I find MEC in this grid or that grid, how is that going to affect my decision making, and is that appropriate in making those decisions? I'm going to try moving slides again and see how it goes. Excellent. So what is the munitions cleanup decision matrix? It's a framework for collaborative decision making. More specifically, it's a site-specific tool for scoping remedial alternatives and framing the negotiation of cleanup decisions. The matrix is just a starting point. It's not a presumptive or default remedy. It's intended to provide both structure and transparency for negotiating and making those cleanup decisions. The tool is intended to be used at the start of the RFS, the scoping process, to identify the range of likely response scenarios. The matrix, the framework for the cleanup decision matrix is based on, first, the types of munitions used in the area and type of munitions use areas likely at the site, and then the range of site usage scenarios likely to occur. The response alternatives are then identified and assigned to make likely response actions based on those combinations. We touched on the fact that we don't have a risk assessment scenario or risk assessment protocol. So what is the role of risk in making cleanup decisions? Munitions risks or explosive safety hazards, if you want to call them, if you want to use that terminology, are really driven by two fundamental factors, hazard and exposure. This is the same basic model used in any other environmental risk assessment. But for munitions, instead of trying to estimate or quantify the risk, I think it's better that we focus on looking rather at how to manage those risks. So for me, I like to shift from a framework of trying to quantify risk to approaches to managing that risk. For munitions, it really comes down to two choices. You can either reduce or remove the munitions hazards, or you can focus on reducing or eliminating those exposures. For a munition site, that means either doing MEC removal actions, surface, subsurface, or if you were in a state that had underwater issues, underwater too, or management of those site uses and user activities, which would come in terms of land use controls. At many munition sites, most FUD sites, we don't get to decide or change site usage. So risk management within the sites. So we have to manage risks within the likely site uses. We do have some tools to help manage behavior and possibly reduce the severity or consequences of exposure on flood sites. But land use controls are a whole other topic, so I'm going to avoid jumping into that. Suffice it to say that for munitions cleanup alternatives, you're really looking at a combination of removing hazards and managing site uses. During the feasibility study, formal cleanup alternatives are developed and evaluated. But first, during the scoping of the RI, likely cleanup options are first identified. For munition sites, the options are really limited and consist of generally some combination of land use controls, surface removal actions, and subsurface removal actions. For today, in illustrating the munitions cleanup matrix, I've decided to come up with a simple combination of general response actions to form four basic alternatives. The no further action alternative, a land use controls only alternative, a surface cleanup with land use controls, and a surface and subsurface with land use controls. Again, I'm going to purposefully avoid any specifics of what those land use controls might be. That's a very site-specific cleanup team determination. So here's an example of the munitions cleanup framework. This would be something that would be developed during the initial scoping by the project team and used to help guide the RFS and ultimate cleanup decision making. First, the project team identifies the likely types of munitions use areas on the site. For this example, I've identified firing points, buffers and safety fans, impact areas, and maneuver areas. You can come up with whatever likely types of munitions use areas make sense for your site. Then we identify the range of site usage scenarios and combine those as appropriate to come up with a reasonable grouping of site usage. For this example, I threw in a wide variety from woods that have little access, agricultural fields, all the way to playgrounds and schools, and in this case, rural home sites. You could put in whatever whatever makes sense for you. For your site, you want to make those as descriptive and site-specific as you possibly can. Going through this, I apologize to the no further action fans. You can put no further action as a likely alternative in your matrix. What the project team then does is they go through and look at for each munitions use area, each type of munitions use area, and each of the site uses, what would be the most likely alternative that would be selected. You'll see that some of them, a site team might come up with a range of alternatives, and that's okay. This matrix is then used by the project team in scoping the remedial investigation. Start asking yourself, what data do we need to be able to apply this matrix to our site? What data might deviate, what might drive deviations from these likely cleanup scenarios? And then what data do we need to cost and design that cleanup matrix? What the matrix does as a framework is really allow for the scoping of likely site-specific decisions without getting bogged down in discussions of trying to quantify risk or deal with outliers or come up with numerical cleanup levels. So I'm going to now give you a quick example of how I've applied this framework, with keeping in mind that this is just a framework. The site-specific example is with the Ruby Gulch Range Complex, which is in the central portion of the Camp Hale FUD site. Ruby Gulch is about 5,000 acres within the larger 150,000-acre Camp Hale. It's located in the White River National Forest, which happens to be the most visited national forest in the country. Ruby Gulch is on the southern slope of a mountainside that's immediately to the north of the main cantonment area. So you've got the main cantonment area, and you've got a mountainside moving up from there. We've got forest access roads moving through the area. The RFS was completed in 2005. We identified the entire area was used for troop maneuver training. There was small arms, pyrotechnics, signal smoke simulators, comwire, sea ration, foxholes, and other types of features to identify military maneuvers having done over the whole hillside. At the top of the MRS, there were also five munitions impact areas identified. Basically, the tops of the slopes were used as impact areas for mortars and 75-millimeter artillery. There was also a small area that was used for anti-tank training, as evidenced by finding, I think we found five anti-tank practice landmines in one small location. The area is all general forest. While some of the site is remote, you have to do a pretty serious hike from road to get to it. There's no wilderness, and it has popular uses with dispersed camping, hiking, fishing, great elk hunting there. Four-wheel drive and ATV tours pass through the area almost daily, and there's a mountain hut located within the munitions response site, although outside the impact area. The hut is actually shown on the screen, so don't interpret the hut as being something small. These are big structures. So what does the cleanup decision matrix look for a site like this? How do I access the arrow? Thank you. So we've got maneuver areas. We have likely firing points. You know, we have an impact area, and the landmine area could be considered a weapons training area. We also know that we've got remote forest and wilderness, general forest areas along roads and trails, and dispersed camping. So how did this play out? During the RFS, for the field investigations, we scoped those based on the site usage. Higher use areas triggered investigation with tighter transect spacing. We took subsurface sampling grids, and we biased those towards the suspected impact areas. We used an iterative approach during the RI to collect the data to reduce the uncertainty in these key decision points within the matrix. For example, in maneuver areas along roads and trails, do we have enough data to decide, do we do land use controls only, or do we need to do additional work? You'll notice that as some of those boxes show with the ranges, at initially when we were scoping it, it really depends on the answers during the RI as to whether or not we think alternative two land use controls or three surface clearance would be the appropriate decision. Quickly, as an example, from a practical perspective, the suspected landmine practice landmine training area Few acres in size, the suspected area, landmine training area would be considered a weapons training area, but not an impact area. The matrix shows that within the general forest and within roads and trails that alternative 2 or 3 might be appropriate. The team ultimately decided on land use controls, and that decision was actually pretty easy to support during the ERI. Although this area is located in the general forest, it's fairly remote. It would take some serious hiking for someone to access the site. There was minimal usage as identified during the RI. We had no evidence of real anti-tank mines being used either in that area or anywhere else on Camp Hale, so we didn't have a concern that there might be non-practice mines. And finally, the decision was made to, during the RI, to do additional efforts to investigate the area and make sure that we reduce the uncertainty over that site. And that ultimately allowed us to support rolling that into a land use controls only decision along with the rest of the maneuver area. Keep in mind, the intent of this framework is to support good decisions. Therefore, we're looking at cleanup decisions that are protective, accepted, and implementable. We used this framework informally with discussions with the Forest Service as well, and helping to bring them on board with the direction for the cleanup decision. I'm clearly not capable of pushing the right buttons.
That is okay. We've got them back up on the screen for you.
Thank you. But keep in mind, let's see, some closing thoughts. Keep in mind this is just a framework. It's focused on scoping out the remedial investigation feasibility study, avoiding surprises, keeping it all transparent so that as you're going through the process, everybody has a good understanding of what the end game is and what the likely decisions and outcomes will be, so that that data can be collected to support those outcomes with the intent of getting to a good cleanup decision. But keeping in mind that these are likely outcomes and really are just should be considered points of departure within the decision-making process. They aren't written in stone, and they're intended to be used for good, healthy site negotiations. With that, I think I've used most of my time, but I'm open to questions if there's time.
Jeff, yes, great job with it. Couple of questions here real quick. One is very simple and straightforward, and that is, and just for clarification, we had one viewer who wanted clarification on if you could state what state Camp Hale is in.
Camp Hale is located in the great state of Colorado.
Outstanding. Very good. Just wanted to...
A little bit north of Vail, between Vail, Aspen, and Leadville.
North of Vail. All right. Yeah, I need to get up there. It's beautiful countryside. I need to get up there as a private citizen now and visit Camp Hale. One other quick question here for you is how are alternatives developed in the RI scoping, you know, prior to determining if a risk is unacceptable? Aren't the alternatives developed during the feasibility study?
Formal alternatives for evaluation are developed under the alternatives during the feasibility study. But if you look at the NCP, the first step in scoping of the RI is identifying your likely cleanup options. The concept, I think, that in putting together the NCP that they looked at was you have to generally know what direction you want to go before you start. And for munitions, it's pretty easy because we don't have a lot of likely cleanup options. So you develop those likely cleanup options, and what I'm recommending is you can use this framework to put some logic behind what would be the likely alternatives for likely situations in your site, and initiate that conversation with your stakeholders so that hopefully when you've made it through the RFS, everyone is on the same page that your decision is defensible and accepted by the community in the state and will get you ultimately to your site closeout, which is really where you want to get.
Okay, excellent. So, yeah, it kind of ties in with that that philosophy of you kind of got to start with the end in mind. So, very good. Jeff, as always, a pleasure. I hope that it's time to move on to our next speaker, but I hope you stick around in case we have some additional questions come up and throw your way. But again, very much appreciate you providing the regulator perspective there. Okay, our next speaker is John Baptiste, and John is with Parsons. He's the lead advanced classification geophysicist with Parsons. He's got many years in working on environmental projects. He has worked on a number of the ESTCP advanced classification demo projects. And so John's going to talk to us a little bit about implementing advanced classification on a removal action. So, John, I hope you're ready to go, and if so, the floor is yours.
All right, thanks. So I'm going to start with a little discussion on how classification works for anyone that hasn't seen that presentation a billion times before. For all those that have, apologies. Then I'm getting into some site-specific factors that will affect the decision of whether or not classification is a good idea for a given removal action. So the EM61 is the most commonly used standard DGM instrument. The way we typically use it in UXO work, it includes a single transmitter and receiver. When it's fired, the transmitter creates a magnetic field that induces current in any subsurface conductors. In our case, we're looking for MEC items. As the induced current decays, it produces a secondary magnetic field that's measured by the receiver. With the EM61, it's at four different time gates during continuous decay. The way the magnetic fields work, the single receiver is really only measuring the response produced by the axis of the object that's perpendicular to the receiver, so in this case, the horizontal axis. And that's the reason the EM61 response is higher if a cylindrical object is oriented vertically or lower if it's horizontal. Advanced sensors, on the other hand, like the Metal Mapper and the TEMTAD shown here, include multiple transmitters and multiple triaxial receivers. The transmitters can either be offset from one another, like the TEMTADs. They're all in the same plane, but they're offset 40 centimeters in each direction from the center of the sensor, or oriented orthogonally, like the Metal Mapper, where they're actually vertical instead of just horizontal. The receivers are smaller cubes spaced across the sensor, which all record data in the X, Y, and Z directions instead of just the Z direction like the EM61. So like the 61, these sensors can be used to collect data dynamically. You can also collect data statically where you spend a relatively long time collecting data in one place. In dynamic data collection, the Z transmitter, the one parallel with the ground, fires, and all of the triaxial receivers record response data. For static or queued data collection, all of the transmitters fire multiple times, and all of the receivers record response data following each transmit pulse. That's called stacking, and stacking the data from multiple transmit-receive cycles can significantly reduce noise in the received data. For both types of data collection, the use of multiple receiver orientation allows the sensors to record the response data specific to each axis of the source object rather than just the axis perpendicular to the single receiver. So in these two slides, one receiver measures the response for the horizontal axis, and another measures the response for the the short axis facing the receiver, and then the long axis facing the receiver. The receivers, the advanced sensor receivers also record a significantly higher proportion of the response decay curve than the EM61, with response measured approximately 20 times after the transmit pulse in dynamic surveys, and from 50 to more than 100 times after the transmit pulse for queued surveys. So if we're looking at the response curve down here, the advanced sensors are essentially measuring this entire curve rather than just the four time gates measured by the EM61. So what does all that extra information do for us? For detection surveys, the fact that there are multiple receivers and the receivers are much smaller than the EM61 receiver allows for significantly higher anomaly resolution and more accurate target positioning, because response is tied to a 12 centimeter wide receiver cube rather than the 1 meter wide receiver on the EM61. The use of later time gates than those available with the EM61 can also reduce response from small near surface clutter, for which the response drops off faster than for larger subsurface sources. This would be true for any environment, but is especially helpful in high density areas. The figures shown here are dynamic EM61 and metal mapper data collected in the same location. So this is the EM61 data, this is metal mapper data. Even with the much larger EM61 anomalies, you can see with the red circles here that these sources identified by the metal mapper probably would not have been identified by the EM61 and never would have been dug. So in addition to better anomaly resolution and location, dynamic advanced sensor data can also be modeled, which can allow for basic discrimination during the dynamic survey. That can be quite helpful if you're looking for large objects and can reject smaller, fast-decaying sources before the queued survey. The one big drawback to dynamic advanced sensor surveys is that it's almost painfully slow. For even on an ideal site, you're looking at about an acre and a quarter a day for a dynamic advanced sensor survey, where an EM61 towed array might get you 12 to 15 acres on the same site. Queued data collection, the sensor is parked over a single target location for 30 seconds to 1 minute while data is collected through a specified number of transmit-receive cycles. Figure on the left here shows queued metal mapper data collected over a single point and the response measured by each of the seven triaxial receivers following the transmit pulses of each of the three transmitters. So in this figure, there are 63 individual decays measured at 50 different time gates each. Modeling or inverting all of these decays using advanced sensor-specific processing software basically boiled all of these 63 decays down into three individual decay curves for the source, which we also call polarizabilities, and that's the figure on the right. Each polarizability curve basically represents the response specific to a specific answer or specific axis of the source object. So this example shows a cylindrical object with one long axis and two almost equal smaller axes, so the red and the green lines. If this had been something like a horseshoe, this would basically be reversed. The two smaller axes would be on top of the two longer axes would be on top of the shorter primary axis that doesn't have a match. Um, So the three polarizabilities produced by a specific object are constant and are completely independent of the orientation of the object and the ground. So if you know the polarizabilities produced by a given object once, you basically know the polarizabilities that will always be produced by that object or an object very similar to it under ideal conditions. So we take advantage of that through library matching. The DoD has produced a library of known polarizability curves for hundreds of different munition types. The polarizabilities in the library can be compared to the polarizabilities measured over unknown sources in the field, measured over unknown sources in the field to determine if the unknown is similar to a known munition or if it just looks like metallic clutter unrelated to mech. Results are expressed as a degree of match or a decision statistic, which you can see up here. So the higher a decision statistic, the better the match between the library item and your unknown. Most dig, no dig decisions on a classification project are going to be made through library matching. With unknowns that closely correlate to a library munition. So this example on the left, where you can see the library item and the unknown are almost exactly the same. Those are going to be investigated while poor matches. So this example on the right, this is a 4.2-inch mortar library signature. Well, this is the response produced by these two things in the picture here. And they look nothing like each other. So that's the kind of thing we leave in the ground. While most classification decisions are based on library matching, there are some other tools such as self-matching or clustering, which is basically shown here. Using those, you can identify sources you might want to dig even if they don't match anything in the library particularly well. So this is called a feature space plot, and the example here shows overall size of the subsurface source on the bottom axis and decay, which is a basic measure of the wall thickness of the subsurface source on the left. So things that have similar shapes, sizes, and wall thicknesses tend to cluster together in the chart. This is pretty helpful in confirming that things you know you're looking for, in this case the 4.2-inch mortars that all group in here, all look like each other, but it's also potentially useful for identifying things that may not be in your library. Some examples of those are the nose frag cluster here and the base plate cluster here. So we dig a couple of those, and you can find out that cluster of things in feature space is, in fact, a base plate or a nose fuse or an MD nose fuse, and that you don't have to dig it, but it is nice knowing what's represented by all these things. And in the event you dig that thing and it turns out to be a target of interest or something you weren't expecting, you can add that to your site-specific library and dig it. The final product of the classification survey is a ranked dig list with sources classified as potential munitions at the top in the dig category and high confidence clutter at the bottom in the no dig category. Any data points with questionable data quality are classified as inconclusive and placed at the top of the list for investigation. Then all sources with usable data are ordered from most likely to be a target of interest to what least likely to be a target of interest. Rather than simply trusting that advanced sensors and classification are perfect, QC seeds with the types and locations known to the contractor and quality assurance seeds completely blind to the contractor will be buried in the survey area. Obviously, these should all be above the dig threshold. But in order to test the dig threshold further, projects these days typically use verification and validation digs. Verification digs are the next 200 items on the dig list after the last target of interest recovered during the intrusive investigation. That may be completely independent of the dig threshold. So if the last target of interest is 300 items above your dig threshold on your dig list, then you've already dug the required 200 before you get to your dig threshold. If the last target of interest is one item above your dig threshold, then you have to dig 199 targets classified as non-digs. There will also be typically be 200 validation digs, rather than just using a straight number on the dig sheet like the next 200. These are chosen from the non-digs by the project decision team by whatever means the team feels is appropriate. So it could be, 200 closest to each other in the same spatial area, potentially uninvestigated cluster and feature space, or it could just be random. Whatever the PDT feels is best for those is typically what happens. If you miss either the validation or verification, if either of those turns out to be TOI, you probably need to reconsider what you've done with classification. So now that everyone completely understands how classification works, I'm going to get into why you want to do it, where it works well, and where it might not work so well. If it works on a given site, the why is pretty easy. Standard removal action, the vast majority of project cost goes to digging up non-MEX scrap metal. So using Camp Butner as an example, there were 146 UXO items recovered in over 500,000 digs on that project. So in the Camp Butner map shown down here, the only thing that really needed to come out of the ground in this map was this one red dot. So if you conclude with confidence that the red dot is the only thing that needs to come out of the ground, you can save a lot of money or at least do more with the money you have. So sorry, on the previous slide, this shows the typical cost represented by digging everything. Whereas if you spend less money on digging things, you can use that money to clear more area or just save it depending on how you're paying for the project. Basically, the difference between those two graphs is that the cost savings allows you to clear about 1.75 acres for the same cost as 1 acre of digging everything. And this graph represents what you can accomplish if you manage to reduce the number of digs by 90%. And that adds up to almost 2.5 acres of clearance for the same price as clearing 1 acre with everything dug. So I actually copied these slides from an old presentation. The numbers are probably off a little bit with some new QC, QA requirements since they were made. But bottom line is still there's a lot of cost savings that can be made when classification works. So with that, the question really becomes, will classification work on a given site? General answer to at least some degree is yes, with the remaining question being how well will it work, which is influenced by a couple of factors. The first is what you're looking for with regard to potential targets of interest. In general, larger is better for classification, with size broken down into three categories. Smaller than 37 millimeters, 37 millimeters and larger, or just larger than 40 millimeters. Basically, the smaller a target of interest is, the more difficult it is for classification to differentiate it from scrap, which is typically made up of fragments of larger munitions. So 20 and 25 millimeter projectiles are particularly hard to separate from frag. 37 and 40 millimeters are a little easier, and depending on your site, they're easier to the point that you could get a 90% reduction without too much trouble. And anything larger than that is generally considered pretty easy unless the site itself and anomaly densities and things like that are particularly bad. Past that, there's a question of the diversity of munitions on the site. So the more entries you have in your site-specific munitions library, the more unknowns from the ground are going to match library items simply because there are more things in the library to match. So sites with a limited number of potential munitions will typically produce fewer digs unless one of the expected munitions is particularly small. Finally, the composition of the munitions matters to some extent. It's generally not a particularly large concern unless the expected munition is thin-walled, like the Lara rockets shown in this figure here. If that's the case, the response decays much faster than something with thicker walls, and it generally matches surface clutter to a much higher degree than something that decays particularly slowly. Another case of composition mattering would be something with almost no metal in it at all. There are some mostly plastic landmines that would be the case for, but it's not a huge range of munitions. Next consideration is anomaly density, which basically can be separated into extremely high or above 3,000 to 4,000 anomalies per acre. Unless you're looking for only extremely large munitions, densities this high will likely lead to questionable data due to so many overlapping signals. At that point, you're probably stuck with a mag and dagger scrape and sift operation before doing anything else. Sites with anomaly densities above 500 anomalies per acre but below 3 or 4,000 are going to be considered high density for an EM61, but could probably be dealt with using an advanced sensor detection survey because it's capable of resolving and locating individual sources where an EM61 might just show a bunch of overlapping anomalies. And that's kind of an example over here on the right. The Metal Mapper Detection Survey was able to identify individual sources at this site where we decided it was impossible with the EM61 data. Sites with less than 500 anomalies per acre, a detection survey with a standard sensor might be possible, and it's probably advisable if you determine it's possible because they're generally much faster and cheaper than advanced sensor surveys. Finally, you need to consider the expected target of interest density at the site. There are just so many native mech items or things that look like mech items at the site that you're going to have to dig 60% of the identified targets just because they're actually mech. There's probably not going to be a whole lot of cost savings to achieve with classification. As far as the site itself is concerned, terrain, vegetation, environmental interference, area closures, and evacuations are some considerations. Most of those are pretty self-explanatory. Flat and open is certainly better than a rocky jungle. Highly weathered, non-magnetic sandy soils are better than highly magnetic lava fields. Environmental interference, which is especially power lines, which is a concern for all DGM instruments, does not seem to be as big a concern for advanced sensors, at least with the dynamic survey. They seem to be a little less affected by power lines than the EM61. Use of advanced sensors and classification might also be advantageous in areas where you're particularly concerned about limiting the amount of digging due to closing public areas or evacuating residents during intrusive operations. That'll work by limiting digging as well as potentially limiting the size of exclusion zones if you can determine the small subsurface source doesn't require a worst case exclusion radius. As far as advanced sensor options, I'm really just going to get into size and transport mechanism. The standard Metal Mapper is typically vehicle transported and is best for open sites where you're not going to hit anything with a massive sled that carries it. GPS integration with the map and in the acquisition software and a measured response indicator means you don't need to flag anomalies before queue data collection. You just drive the Metal Mapper to the selected target using the GPS and then refine the collection location based on response. The TEMPADS or the MetalMapper 2x2, which is new and being produced by Geometrics commercially, are essentially the same thing as far as transmitter and receiver positioning is concerned. They're typically operator transported and can be used in treated areas or rougher terrain than the MetalMapper. The MetalMapper 2x2 features the same reacquisition capabilities as the MetalMapper, while the TEMPADS actually requires anomalies to be flagged before Q data collection. Finally, the MPV is the least commercially available sensor, but it's smaller than either of the other two and can be carried by a single operator over even worse terrain than either of the other two sensors. The last factor to consider, but probably definitely not the least, is stakeholder input. This is the same slide or same figure I had for the Camp Butner slide. So this survey area is seemingly full of large subsurface sources, and even if classification works perfectly, the stakeholders, whoever they are, can sign off on digging your one red dot here and then leaving everything else in the ground. So state regulators have also been subcontracting data review to third-party companies for a number of recent projects. Some consideration may need to be given to what these third-party reviewers request as far as QA, QC, and project deliverables are concerned, versus what might be typical of a core-only project. That may be of lesser concern once classification accreditation is implemented and classification organizations can point to accreditation body acceptance of policies and procedures. I'm going to end with a couple of examples of specific sites. First was West Mesa, which was a former Kirtland Air Force Base bombing range in Albuquerque. This was a pretty ideal site for classification. The only targets of interest there were 100-pound high-explosive bombs and intact 100-pound practice bombs that may have still held a spotting charge. Anomaly densities at the site were generally low enough that EM61 dynamic surveys were sufficient to identify the sources for follow-on Q data collection. Site was entirely flat and open with little geologic variability, and we had the New Mexico Environment Department and EPA pretty much on board and accepting the classification approach from the start. It was immediately adjacent to a regional airport, and some of the EM61 targets were close enough that shutting down the airport during intrusive operations was a possibility. But the classification survey determined these were all clutter and airport operations were never affected. The one target center where anomaly densities were too high for the 61, a MetalMapper dynamic survey was able to accurately identify Q data collection locations, and the end result was a 94% reduction in digs and a substantial cost savings over digging what would have been an additional 5,400 targets and a potential scrape and sift in the target center without classification. Onto a less ideal site, Marpy Point Field in Saipan. It's a site that had been subject to shelling by the Navy and a land invasion by the Marines and Army in World War II. Potential munitions range from 20-millimeter to 5-inch projectiles and everything in between, and also included mortars, rockets, and grenades. The majority of the site required extensive brush cutting, and because it's a volcanic island, there was a lot of variability in the geology across the site, which basically depended on the amount of magnetic rock in the soil. There were also a high percentage of native mech items, some of which had deformed through lower detonations and some that had just deteriorated over the past 70 years. Typically, those aren't huge obstacles to overcome, the deformation and deterioration, but when combined with the geologic variability, it did make things a lot more difficult there. As far as that site was concerned, the advanced sensor dynamic data actually looked a little better than the AM61 data due to the geology, but it was also particularly slow as usual. And as far as the QT rate was concerned, the required dig rate was a relatively high 46.5%, and we determined in the end that digging everything was just more cost-effective than collecting Q data and still digging roughly half of the identified targets. So that's all I've got.
Very good, John. Great presentation. We did have a couple of questions that came in, but I think I'm going to hold those either until the end of Greg's presentation or until the Q&A session at the end of the webinar. And so for everybody out there, you know, we've got scheduled now a brief intermission, 15 minutes, but please stay with us. We are going to segue into kind of part two of John's presentation. He's going to be followed up by Greg Vann, and then Nick Stolte's got a presentation talking about end states, and I know that it is a terrific material also. So we'll take a 15-minute break, and everybody stretch, no deep vein thrombosis during one of my webinars, and come back at 5 till the hour. We will start sharp at 5 till. Thank you. Okay, Gene, I see that we have, looks like we're getting the content loaded. I think we're ready. If you are, I'll introduce our next speaker if you're ready to go.
I am, absolutely.
Excellent. Okay. Well, I'll tell you what, our next speaker is also from Parsons, Greg Vann. Greg's got, he also has quite a few years working with munitions projects, including some of the STCP demo projects for advanced classification. And Greg's presentation is almost kind of a part two, if you will, of John's presentation, kind of the complementary side of things, because Greg's going to be talking to us a little bit about management considerations for advanced classification during a remediation or a removal action. So, Greg, if you're ready, then I'm going to turn it over to you.
All right. Thanks, Dwayne. So, yeah, as Dwayne said, John described a lot of the overall technical processes for advanced classification. And I'd like to talk a little bit about some of the key overall management implications for advanced classification and maybe add a few elements that relate to the upcoming accreditation requirements, that sort of thing. So I think we're all familiar with the goal of advanced classification to remove anomalies identified as potential TOI while minimizing the other excavations for munitions debris and other metal that doesn't really pose a potential explosive hazard. And the starting point for this process is really the DPP, where one of the key elements is to discuss the DQOs using the EPA seven-step process. John touched on the need for evaluating the munitions list for the project. Typically, for advanced classification, the munitions of interest are larger than 37 millimeter, but there's definitely cases where it can still be used effectively for smaller items such as 20 millimeter projectiles. Other items come into play as far as the potential for fuses or spotting charges, that sort of thing. And then during the TPP, in addition to the munitions list, there's a discussion about the site-specific classification library, which is a subset of the overall comprehensive library that the Army has developed with other contractors that includes, for the most part, most of the known and suspected munitions for different sites. So we try to come up with some agreement as far as which items need to be included in the site-specific library. The TPP would also begin by a discussion of some of the key decision rules for dynamic surveys or the queued reacquisition surveys. And some of these are fairly basic, but it needs to be recorded and accepted as far as things like if during the dynamic surveys that if there's a detected anomaly and it exceeds the threshold, then that's going to be further evaluated during the queued survey. Or during the queued survey, if an item is classified as a TOI, then it's going to be included on the big list and be intrusively investigated. So those sorts of things would be included on as part of the decision rules. So the QAP, the Quality Assurance Project Plan, which I'm sure is everybody's favorite topic, I really depend on folks like John Baptiste or Craig Murray to help develop and finalize the QAP for advanced classification projects. And the QAP is the work plan type document that includes the standard operating procedures, safety elements, seed requirements, that sort of thing. So for the SOPs, it's the contractor that provides the SOPs, and these, as part of the QAP process, are reviewed by the client. And then ultimately for accreditation, the accreditation auditors will also review these SOPs to make sure they're sufficient for their intended purposes. The QAP also includes the typical safety elements, your APP and SSHP, explosive safety submission, your management plan. And then the seed requirements are specified in a blind seed firewall plan, with the idea being that even if the contractor is placing QC seeds, it still needs to be kept separate from the operational side of the work. And typically, we're using industry standard objects, ISOs as seeds. Where possible, we're using inert munitions items that represent the TUIs, the targets of interest that have been deemed appropriate for the site. And one point I want to make, I've listed the seed detector versus a munitions detector, because I've seen on some of these projects where we build an extra conservative approach using the seeds, and the seed might actually have a threshold that's lower than the target of interest. So it seems that we're often building in an extra barrier or layer of conservatism in these projects, so that we can kind of get away from what the overall objective is. The real objective is to make sure that we can find the targets of interest, and we just want to make sure that we're not getting too far into the weeds of actually designing something that's more of a seed detector than a munitions detector. So on logistics, I've included some slides from a typical site. The upper image shows the surface suite team that's doing a pre-DGM survey. There's the EM61 towed array, the center image, and then the metal mapper that's being pushed along using a skid steer tractor. And that the logistics, some of the key logistics for field work, obviously, are getting proper personnel and equipment. And the personnel that are involved with the data collection aspect of a classification project, there's more stringent requirements as far as qualifications, training, experience. The equipment, John's already kind of talked through the range of different classification sensors. Different tow vehicles include the use of skid steers, both wheeled and tracked, tractors, forklifts have been used. One lesson learned that we seem to have found is that the tracked vehicles are better at collecting the metal mapper dynamic data, since the vehicle itself doesn't bounce around quite as much as a wheeled vehicle. And then I think our experience has been, for the most part, that pushing the sensors in front versus towing behind is typically more effective. So for data collection, I've listed some of the key aspects that relate to dynamic detection, queued reacquisition, data collection. John kind of touched on the different production rates for advanced sensors versus towed arrays. That's definitely a point that has to be considered. For the advanced sensors, we're seeing, you know, around an acre a day for production, as opposed to the EM61 towed arrays, we're, you know, getting 8 to 12 acres a day in production. So there's kind of a trade-off as far as what type of resolution do you need for anomaly location. If it's a real high-density area, then the slower production rate using the advanced sensors is often worth that effort, whereas if it's a less dense area, it's often more effective to collect the data using a towed array. Both detection surveys would typically require that you come back and queue each data point to get the classification information as far as whether or not you're going to need to dig the item or if you can leave it behind. Some typical QC checks would be your function tests or IVS tests. And then the MPCs, the measurement performance criteria, these define how different tasks are going to be evaluated to ensure that they've been done properly. I mean, some of the new acronyms in the class between the DQOs, the MQOs, the MPCs, the DFWs, it gets a little confusing, but I've listed some of the MPCs here that we've been involved with as far as the need for defining the QC seeding, what the criteria is going to be for analog removal, detection surveys, classification, and intrusive. And then the field change requests, the FCRs, these are documents that indicate document the changes that needed to be updated in the QAP. They weren't anticipated during the initial development, but as you go forward, you might find something in, for example, a change in the sensor configuration that had to be modified, or the way a function test, or the way the target threshold was determined. We had an issue at one of the sites where there were power lines, and we changed the approach from using just an analog survey under the power lines to collecting the detection data with the metal mapper, which surprisingly was quite a bit, was affected significantly less than the EM61 sensors. And that turned out to be an effective way to collect that data under the power lines. There were some topographic issues on one portion of the site where it was fairly wooded, and there was some concerns about ecological receptors. So we changed the approach to minimize how much mechanized equipment would be brought into that area. That also involved a change in the survey unit designation. So we cordoned off this area along the vegetated creek to its own survey unit, which would then be have data collected using man-portable equipment instead of a towed array or a skid steer type vehicle. We also had a field change request for the way the IMU was evaluated to make sure that that was providing the correct information on the pitch and roll of the sensor as the dynamic data was being collected. So data processing, I've included an example of a flow chart here for the anomaly detection survey. But in the QAP, I think there's probably about 10 of these different flow charts for different aspects of the project. And each element of the flow chart ties back to different definable features of work, the DFWs that are in the QAP. The DFWs typically include the MQOs for that particular task, which might also involve some of the QC checks. And there's a significant effort going through each of these for the different tasks, use of checklists to make sure that each element has been covered. Then just a note as far as deliverables, obviously the file sizes for the data that we're collecting are significant. So you need a suitable use of a suitable transfer site to actually get the information to the client and stakeholders. I mentioned subcontractor processing, where the prime contractor on the classification project might involve a subcontractor to help with that analysis. And so that involves a certain amount of coordination or communication in terms of requirements that need to be used, data submittals. And this can also, or coming up, has the potential for some accreditation issues. Typically, the subcontractor personnel under the accreditation process are going to need to work under the PRIME's quality management system. So it'll require some training for the quality management and some demonstration of their capabilities to make sure that everything's being followed through on the requirements for accreditation. So QA, QC, there's the measurement quality objectives again, MQOs, that are included in the definable features of work for equipment checks, positioning checks, processing, that sort of thing. Again, seeding, the QC seeding is really intended to verify the process, to make sure that the process is working appropriately to find TOI. The QA validation seeding is another key component of the classification process. It's really much larger ramifications for missing a validation seed. For the QC seeds, we typically increase the number of QC seeds so that if there are any potential problems that occur, we are able to identify those internally and make the appropriate adjustments. If the process has gone on and there's actually a QA seed that's missed, then that has some fairly large ramifications in terms of potential stop work or stand down that would need to be implemented to evaluate what's gone wrong in the process. And I've posted a couple of questions here. If there was the need for a QC review, stand down, which tasks have to come to a stop? I mean, if you're still doing brush clearing and surface sweep, I would imagine that we could get fairly quick concurrence that those tasks can continue while the specific issue is is resolved. But the idea is that things would come to a halt, the issue would be identified, we'd fix the problem. Another question I've posed is, so if the contractor isn't at fault, there's some other issue that's occurred for missing a validation, see, are they going to be compensated for the downtime for that? Food for thought of what are some of the ramifications of this type of process where you've got to stop and review the tasks and issues that are going on with the missed validation seed. Another aspect of the QA/QC came up recently on a project where we had some QC seed migration. So this photo shows the location of where the buried seed was underneath the staff of the GPS. This is the location where the QC seed was buried back in 2015. We performed the dynamic survey, and it located the seed in the proper location. And then between the dynamic survey, the time for the dynamic survey and the queued survey, the queued survey identified the location of that seed about a half a meter away. So that was a problem. And the interesting thing here is this has happened twice. So the seed was buried, and then a prairie dog came in and kicked the seed out while it was digging a hole for its new home. So, you know, question for this obviously is, you know, if this was a validation seed, would the project have to stop work? Hopefully it can be evaluated very quickly and we could move on, but we're kind of looking to see where Bill Murray is to help us out. Some other aspects of the classification, similar to other projects, removal action projects, there's the daily and weekly reports, QC reports. Part of the new GCMR QAP process for classification are the data usability assessments, the DUAs, that are intended to provide overall assessment of data quality and usability of the information. And these DUAs can be based on the overall project site, or they could be based on each survey unit that's included for the site. And these are typically used to validate the dynamic detection survey, the queued data, dig list, final results. So it's fairly intensive and requires fairly rapid or quick development so that you can move on to the next stage. Another aspect of the reporting are the access databases that are kept up, an overall method for, you know, tracking the survey results and information, again, for the dynamic surveys, queued targets, the QC information, intrusive data, both for analog, standard, classification. All that's typically included in the different access databases that are submitted to the client. Some challenges that we've had on projects, implement weather delays. Snow has been a challenge out here in Colorado. Obviously, the ability to see the ground surface is challenging for surface clearance work. And then for collecting dynamic surveys, the sensor height change due to the presence of snow is a problem, in addition to just the cold weather working conditions. Your logistics for personnel and equipment, as we're moving towards accreditation, the requirements for training and qualifications of personnel are becoming to the forefront. Obviously, the equipment requires proper selection and setup. Software issues can come to play between the new versions of UX Analyze or EM3D. We've had some challenges with the IMUs, the inertial measurement unit, and the way the sign for pitch and roll might be applied based on the different software that's being used. We've had some challenges with transmitter and receiver board. For the most part, the metal mappers work extremely well, but on occasion we've had some board issues where during the function and IVS tests, we identified that one of the receiver cubes wasn't working properly or a transmitter board wasn't working properly, and that had to be sent back to Geometrics to get that resolved and then bring it back and keep things moving along. Then on the intrusive investigation for a classification project, the targets of interest that are on the dig list that's been classified, typically we have increased documentation in terms of photographs, whiteboard information, so that if there's any questions about what was pulled out of the ground, we can go back to that information, and in addition to the GPS locations that were taken when that item was taken out of the ground, so that it can be accurately compared against the source location that was identified during the processing versus the intrusive results. John touched on the verification and validation digs that are included on the dig list. The verification digs are typically intended to ensure that the data are collected properly and assist in evaluating the library matching process or the stop dig threshold. The validation digs are intended to help make sure that items are correctly classified during the classification process. The results of the classification are compared with the intrusive results. The project team for validation digs might decide on a variety of criteria, including cluster analysis, feature space, or maybe just a random selection might be utilized. And then lastly, a little bit on accreditation challenges that may come up. Typically, a contractor needs to have some current AC projects, or at least it's easier, because that way you're going to have existing SOPs. You've got a project for the accreditation body to audit. And then I've put down, you know, again, this issue of the consequence of QA validation seed failures. I mean, the prairie dog incident, that could be a real problem if we've gone through the accreditation process and now we've got this validation seed failure through no fault of our own, and it'll be interesting to see how those types of things are handled. So appreciate your time.
Very good, Greg. And I have to say, I love your tie-in there with Caddyshack. especially in view of the prairie dog incident with the seed item. But yeah, one of the great movies of all time, and I can imagine you thinking au revoir, go fair. So I hope you'll stick around. We do have a couple of questions relative to yours and John's presentation, but right now we're on schedule to move ahead with our next speaker, and our next speaker is Mr. Nick. And Nick is he's a Louisville Cardinal. He's an engineer with the Huntsville Center, and has worked with munitions for a number of years now. And I've known Nick for a number of years, and I would like to think that I've been something of a mentor to part of Nick's career here. He may look at it as me being a tormentor instead of a mentor, but Nick's a very sharp guy and has become one of my favorite people at the Corps of Engineers. So, Nick, this looks like it's going to be a great presentation. You ready?
I'm ready. Thanks, Dwayne. Absolutely, you've been a mentor to me in my career, and I was surprised. That was the first I'd heard of your retirement, and definitely going to miss you in the workplace. Not only have you been a mentor, but you're a good friend, and we'll miss you in the office, but hopefully we'll be able to hang out outside of work still on occasion. So thanks for that. So what I'm going to talk about here is kind of a relatively new concept, or at least a new way of looking at an old concept, is the vertical conceptual site model and how that relates to the remedial action objective. So to do that, I'm going to step through just kind of a few topics, and some we'll cover in more detail than others, but kind of five basic topics. Cover the remedial investigation objectives, and then the conceptual site model development, with the emphasis really being on the post-RI CSM. The overall concept of this webinar is remedial and removal actions. So we're gonna kind of look past the RI and going into the remedial action. You can't talk about a remedial action without talking about a remedial action objective. There's been a lot of work gone in by a lot of people at the CX and others to kind of refine this whole concept of remedial action objectives. And some of that has been kind of mentioned before. Those that have been involved and maybe seen some of these slides will kind of look familiar. But we're going to talk about vertical distribution and then, of course, the post-remedy data assessment in certain end states. So jumping right in here, the purpose of the remedial investigation, what will we know that we don't know already? And the way I like to think about the remedial investigation, I like to think of it as it's a science project. I mean, one of the reasons that I got into munitions response is because it was something that was very tangible. It's something that I could understand. I could break it down into simple terms and wrap my mind around it. And so everybody learned the scientific method back in elementary school. And so then we develop a hypothesis, which is our conceptual site model, and what we think is going on at the site. We think that there's going to be some sort of concentrated munitions use area at a certain spot, for example, because we know that was a target area where they were firing artillery at. And we think that the land use is such and such based on what the data we've gathered in the PA and the SI. So we've got this whole concept of, or hypothesis of what we think the site's going to look like. And then we're going to develop a sampling plan to go out and try to prove that our hypothesis or our conceptual site model is right. So just kind of one of the purposes of the RI, and this is just a generic purpose statement, and this is kind of on a different track of what we're trying to accomplish, or one of the things that we're trying to do, is to investigate the project area. In our case, that's going to be the MRS, to define nature and extent of relief. Of course, we all know about nature and extent, but sometimes we forget about this determination of acceptable versus unacceptable risk to support a recommendation for one of the following. So, at the end of the RI, we're going to say one of three things. Either no further action is required because there's no unacceptable risk, or the risk is acceptable, negligible, not there, however you want to say it. or we say there is an unacceptable risk at this site, and we need to conduct a feasibility study to evaluate remedial alternatives. The third one, I hope we're never in this situation. We shouldn't be with all that's gone into our planning and setting up the DQOs, but there is a chance that you say, inconclusive, go do more work. So on that note, I'm going to move on, and I always like to use this quote just to kind of remind people of where we're at when we're talking about the RI. And this is straight out of the EPA RIFS guidance, and I'm going to read this in full. The objective of the RIFS process is not the unobtainable goal of removing all uncertainty, but rather to gather information sufficient to support an informed risk management decision regarding which remedy appears to be most appropriate for the given site. So the point there is that we're not going to remove all uncertainty. There's always going to be some uncertainty involved that we have to deal with. And that's not just in the RIFS world. You know, that's in life. At the end of a munitions response, I might be able to tell you with all the confidence I could ever have that there are no munitions left on that site, but I can't say it from a statistical standpoint 100% any more than I can say that there's no munitions in your backyard. There's always some uncertainty with regards to everything. You know, hopefully we think the sun's going to rise in the morning, but I guess when it comes down to it, we won't know until that happens. So we got to manage that uncertainty, and we got to bound it. As scientists and engineers, we're gonna recognize that uncertainty and put some limits on it, and recognize how much uncertainty we can live with, and how much we can't, and what we might have to do, and then that's gonna help inform our risk management decision. So I'd like to drive that point home. So moving on now to CSM development. So the conceptual site model, you know, this is really what drives us. This is our understanding of the site, and like someone mentioned earlier, I think it was Dwayne, you know, at the end of the remedial action, it's no longer a conceptual site model, it's just the site model. You know, we'll never have any more information than we do at that point. But up until that point, it's conceptual, it's a dream, it's kind of a fantasy. So let's develop a list of what our dream CSM might look like. And so here's some of the things that I would look for in my dream CSM. I would want it to have a concentrated munitions use area. I would want it to also identify where there were non-concentrated munitions use areas. I'd want to know where there's unacceptable risk from mech hazards and areas with no unacceptable risk. I'd also want my dream CSM to identify the specific type of mech in relative quantities. So I want to know not just mech, but you know, is it 60 millimeter mortars? Is it 155s? You know, what is it? And what is it about those things that makes them so dangerous? Are they highly sensitive? If they detonate, is it just going to, you know, send me to the emergency room, or is it a total catastrophe? And I want my CSM to have some depth. There's got to be a depth and a distribution profile. And then also the CSM, it's got to have, you know, some of the intangibles, some of the things that maybe aren't quite as scientific, but I need to know about them, like the land use and the access conditions that gets to my receptors, the land use depths, you know, the exposure pathways. And then, of course, looking with the end in mind, I need to establish what kind of detection limit I have. Oh, hold on. Okay, we're back.
Don't worry about that. I'll come right back. There you go.
Okay, cool. So I need to know about the detection limit for specific munitions and specific instruments. So now I've got the list of the CSM of my dream. Now I'm going to go out and look for it. I'm not sure I have controls. Let me try the arrows. Click on the screen first. Okay.
And you come back.
Okay. Okay. Now I can go back and forth. Okay. So is this the CSM of my dream? I know we've all seen CSMs that look like this. But I'll tell you guys what, I'm going to swipe left on that one. PIS now is something that we're kind of used to seeing, and it's okay. It's we know that this is from RI data. We know that the pink blob in the middle is a high anomaly density area, and if those anomalies are consistent with UXO or munitions debris, we probably make a determination that's a concentrated use area. But this CSM is really lacking the depth that I'm looking for. And so when I say depth, here's kind of an example of what I'm talking about. Now, you notice in the top right, I've got RI. So as I go through this talk, I'm going to bounce back and forth a little bit. So I put those in there to kind of remind us at what point in the process we're at. So this is RI data that I'm showing you here. This is actual RI data. Now, it wasn't from this beautiful mountain scene. It was at a place slightly less beautiful. But it's kind of just a different way to show it. And we can just, real quickly at a glance, we can see, okay, yeah, most of the stuff at the top, you know, the gray dot are munitions debris, and the colored dot are mech items that were found that correspond with the legend there. So you can see most of the stuff's at the top with a heavy concentration at 5 inches, and then it goes down to, you know, about 25 inches, and then it doesn't really seem like there's anything. So we all kind of intuitively understand that, or those of us that have worked in the industry for a little while understand this stuff doesn't go on forever. But in my opinion, I think we've done a really poor job of bounding that. I rarely review RIs that say met contamination extends to such and such depth. You know, we have no problem doing it from a lateral perspective, even if it's just the MRS boundaries. But we've got to be able to draw that line from a vertical perspective as well. We got to identify that extent. I mean, I know we're not in a situation like this, right? I think I can confidently say that that we're within at least the confines of the crust of the Earth. So we're here, okay? So that's very important. That's gonna help inform our remedial action objective, and help ultimately inform our decision. But that's not enough. We need other things. So say for example we bound it here at just below the deepest mech item detected. Now this is going to be a project specific decision. We could have gone with the deepest MD item or some other criteria that makes sense and that we can justify. Point is we're going to bound it and say that's how deep the contamination goes. But that's still just a piece of the puzzle. We need to consider other things, like land use. And I love this graphic, especially when I compare it to the graphic before, because it just instantly hits you like there's a big difference between an open field and a mountain valley and this situation where you've got backhoes and shovels going right down into the mech. So I think that really kind of drives home the point of the importance of land use. But again, these guys are not drilling to the center of the Earth. So we're going to bound that land use somewhere. So, for example, here. Now, at this point, we've got to also consider conservatism. And engineers will typically build in conservatism to those variables that we have the least amount of certainty to. And in my opinion, I would recommend if there's going to be conservatism, it's built into the land use step, because that's probably where we are most uncertain. We're trying, with land use depth, we're trying to predict future human behavior. With depth of contamination, you know, that's we can pretty accurately predict where that is based on actual data. So there's a lot less uncertainty with regards to that. But land use depth, but again, we're still gonna bound it somewhere. And then so now we've got three key pieces of the puzzle that's going to help us to develop a really nice remedial action objective that might look something like this. We're going to reduce the unacceptable risk due to the presence of, and that's where we're going to name our specific munitions, We've got them listed there. Within, you know, our horizontal boundary and depth, that which would be the lesser of the depth of contamination or the land use depth, to address exposure to the receptors and the pathways. So those are the who we're going to protect and what mechanisms that they might be exposed to, such that an acceptable risk level is achieved. So I know it's kind of wordy, but it covers all the stuff, and it's definitive, and it's measurable. So at the end of a remedial action, we can make a very definitive statement that says, yes, we accomplished this objective, or no, we didn't. If you've got an RAO that's, minimize or eliminate human exposure to MEC, you know, that's good. That's a good goal or to have, but that's not something that we can really measure and say whether or not we've achieved that. So this is the direction as a program where we want to go with the RAO. So along with that, and Jeff mentioned earlier about acceptable end states and showed us the example from Fort Huachuca. Well, this is kind of another way to look at acceptable end states in terms of a flow chart. And so at the bottom, we've got some different scenarios. The green polygons would be acceptable and the red one being unacceptable. And we're going to use this flow chart both before the remedial action, actually in the feasibility study where we're evaluating alternatives, and we want to see which alternative will get us to an acceptable end state, and specifically which acceptable end state. And then we're also, after the remedial action, when we do our post-remedy data assessment, we're going to see if we did what we thought we were going to do. So we're always planning, and we're always measuring, and we're always comparing what we actually did with what we thought we were going to do, and just constantly checking ourselves. So this flowchart goes something like this. Did the physical remedy support an acceptable end state? So first we're just looking at, you know, the actual digging stuff up. If that's no, then we've got to consider, will the inclusion of land use controls support an acceptable end state? If that's yes, implement the land use controls and we're good. Of course, we'll be doing five-year reviews and we're not saying anything about UUUE at that point. But if digging stuff up and land use controls doesn't get us to an acceptable end state, and the answer is no, then, you know, go back to go. Do not collect $200, start all over. Hopefully you're never in that situation. You've done better planning that. Going down the left side just real quick, okay, say our physical remedy did support an acceptable end state. So now we got to think about UUUE, and that's kind of going to be a lot of times, well, it's going to be based on one of those two lines, the depth of contamination or the land use depth. You know, if our remedy is protective only down to a certain depth, but our contamination is beneath that depth, then we're really counting on that depth, that land use depth staying fixed. And if it moves, then we're no longer protective. So that's not a UUUE scenario, but it could be. So we've got to look at that. And I can explain that a little bit better here in the next graphics. So vertical distribution, what's down there and how far does it go? Now, I've already shown you one way to look at vertical distribution and just the plot with the little dots. But here's another way that we can look at, really, this is the same data. So what we've done here is just plot it a different way where we've got the MEC and the MD. And you can see that the MEC items, for the most part, track right along with the MD. You know, where we have the most MD is where we have the most MEC. And you can see that distribution where it really peaks out, you know, there around the 4 to 5 inch range, just like we could tell on the previous graphic. But again, this is from RI data. So this is an estimation of what the distribution is across the site. You know, this is transecting grid data, not removal action data, so I got to emphasize that. So since it's an estimation, we might want to do something like this, you know, make a curve. And so that's what I'm going to carry forward using that curve in the next couple of slides. So this is another way to look at the vertical distribution. Same thing. You know, the grass, that's our surface, and the blank space is everything subsurface. So, you know, here's just an example distribution similar to the one shown before, where, you know, the highest concentration is there just beneath the surface, and then it kind of tapers off. So we need to know that. But, of course, we also need to know this land use depth or this action limit. And that's really important because that's the depth that we need to protect to. And what that also implies is that there's no exposure beneath that depth. So we're not really concerned with what's beneath that depth because there's no exposure pathway. So that's also why I say that if you're going to build in conservatism, it's probably with that line because you have the least amount of certainty. But then there's one other line that we've got to consider, and I mentioned it in the list of CSM things that we're looking for, is this concept of the detection limit. Okay, so here I've got a detection limit that is above my action limit, and it's also above the deepest neck that's been recovered. So, you know, I've got a gap there. And what's that gap represent? Well, it represents uncertainty because I know that in this example that I'm showing you, I know that my technology is limited to a certain depth, and that's shallower than the depth that I need to protect to. So now I've got to manage that uncertainty. So that's probably one of those situations where, going back to the flow chart, my physical removal, I would not think that alone would achieve the RAO, and I would probably have to consider some land use controls in addition to manage that uncertainty. But what if my detection limit's down here, right at the action limit, but also well below the deepest munitions item? So now that gap, that becomes confidence. Now I can say I can reliably detect down to the depth at which I need to protect people, and it's well below where all the munitions were found. So I've got, you know, a safety buffer, a confidence there. Take a look at a couple other scenarios. So say the distribution is like this. So that's where one example of, you know, I don't really have a lot of uncertainty, but I don't have a ton of confidence either. So, you know, that one could go either way. We'd really have to take a closer look at what we think we can accomplish and how much, you know, how sure we are of the land use depth and detection limit. But so if our detection limit's down here beneath the land use depth and also at the bottom of where we've recovered all the munitions, you know, now, of course, I've got that gap, which represents confidence. One more example here. So this one, yes, I've got confidence because I can detect well below the depth at which I need to protect to, but the munitions keep going beneath my detection limit. So I'm really, really relying on that land use depth to remain static. So that might be one of those situations where my physical remedy achieves the RAO, but if that land use depth were to drop down, for example, then I might no longer be protective. So that would be a pretty good example of one of those situations where, yeah, I've achieved the RAO with physical remedy alone, but I can't really say it's UUUE because when that land use, I'm relying on that land use depth to be at a certain point. So we talk about detection limits. We need to really kind of understand what that means. And that is the confidence in which we can reliably detect an item in its least favorable orientation, or that we're going to basically see it every time. So in this graphic, you know, we've drawn the line, and the scale going to the right is our level of confidence going to 100%. So at the detection limit, we're high confidence, 100%. We think the technology is always going to find what we want it to find every time to a certain depth. Now, that doesn't mean that we're not going to be able to detect things below that depth. So it tapers off. You know, we have a reduction in confidence, and as we get deeper and deeper, and then at a certain point, we can no longer detect items. They're just too deep. So all that means is in that zone, just below the detection depth, we have an increased possibility of false negatives. So because of that, the detection limit becomes really important. When we're designing a remedial action and we're saying that we can detect to a certain depth, you know, our ability to make these decisions about whether or not we've achieved an RAO relies on that to be accurate. So we constantly have to check ourselves, and one of the ways that we do that is with these QC seeds, quality control. So we're going to put little pieces of pipe that are similar, the industry standard objects that are similar to the munition, and we're going to put them, you know, right there around that detection limit, and so we can over and over prove to ourselves, because we know they're there, so we can make sure if, as long as our instrument continues to detect those things, we know it's working. We can just continue to prove to ourselves that yeah, we're right about that detection limit. And on top of that, we're going to have quality assurance seeds. That's more of a system test that will be somewhat shallower. So going back to the distribution post-RI. Remember, so we've got the surface. We've got our action depth. You know, we're coming out of the RI, and this is part of our conceptual site model, the depth at which we're going to protect to. We've got our detection limit because this has been established during the RI, because hopefully we're using similar instrumentation. And not to go off too much on a tangent, but that is one of the reasons that we would like to use classification even in the RI phase, because it's kind of a little mini pilot study for a site-specific. And then we're also going to have our predicted distribution. Now, I made this one a dashed line because I want to emphasize that this is predicted. This is based on transects and grids. So I think the distribution looks like that. It's above my detection limit. It's above where I need to protect to. So I think that there's confidence there. So with that information, that's going to help develop that remedial action objective. So then I go out and do the work, okay? You know, nothing has changed. My detection limit is still the same. My land use depth action limit is still the same. The only thing that's going to change is what the actual distribution is, because this post-remedy, this is, you know, after I've gone out and done my detection survey, and if we're using classification, you know, I've queued on all the anomalies, I've removed all the targets of interest, I've done all the associated QC and QA, and done my verification and validation digs. So I've dug up everything that I think that I need to dig up, and I record the depth at which those items are dug, so I can plot, you know, the real distribution, and say, for example, you know, it was just more items than I imagine. So with that information, now, you know, I'm no longer in the conceptual site model phase. This is the site model. This is the real site model. And so I can look at this, and I can ask myself, did we meet the RAO? And I think I can hear everybody out there nodding their head, yes, we met the RAO with some level of confidence there, because the deepest thing that we dug up was well within the range of what we can detect. So going back to our chart, so this is how, again, we're going to use the same logic that we did to make our predictions about what a particular remedial action or remedial alternative would be able to achieve, and we're going to see if what it did achieve. And so in the example that I just showed, I think that the physical remedy supported an acceptable end state because the deepest thing was shallower than our detection depth and shallower than the level at which we need to protect. So I'm going over to the left. Is UUUE supported? Well, in that case, I think we'd have, you know, going back, I think we'd have a strong argument to say yes, because I know that I can detect everything to a certain level, and everything was well above that, so I've got a certain level of confidence. So I think in this situation, and some of these situations are real, that you could make the statement that I think we got it all. There's no level of uncertainty that I that I can demonstrate. Now, if it were a situation where the actual curve went beneath the detection limit, that'd be a different story. And so that's kind of it. That's the concept, and I think that ties into some of the earlier presentations, and I hope that makes sense to everybody. So to summarize then, I'm going to quote Dirty Harry. I think it was Dirty Harry that said, a PDT's got to know its depth limitations. It was something close to that. So the depth matters. We're going to bound that, and we need to know what we think we can achieve, and we need to continuously measure that and then assess it at the end to see if we did what we said we were going to do. And the remedial action objective has also got to identify that depth. We got to know what it is that we're trying to do in the first place, right? We've got to consider that distribution, you know, where do we expect to find things? And then, of course, as I just showed, we're going to use a post-remedy data assessment to determine if that RAO was achieved. And with that, I will open it up for questions.
Nick, you the man. Swap right. Absolutely. Good job.
Thank you. I was wondering if anybody would get that joke.
Well, that was good. Well done. Great material. Good foundation. A few questions that came in here, and one, I'll read the question, and I bet you can probably home in on which of your colleagues sent this question in. But on your vertical CSM with the beautiful mountain backdrop, what's the horizontal scale on your graph? You're supposed to be an engineer, so.
Yeah, they're picking on me. There is no scale on that one. And it would be, I agree, that would be much better if that could match up to say like the heat map from the geophysical investigation. But in that example, no, there is no scale. They're just spaced out, you know, according to how they were put in on the Excel sheet. So
yeah.
Busted.
Yep. They're working on you there.
Yep.
Okay, so let's see. Here's a question. You know, you had the example RAO, the one, the narrative. So on your example RAO, you know, how can you measure that you've achieved an acceptable risk level?
Well, we've been working on that. There's a team, and I didn't want to go down that road because that wasn't the focus of this talk. But you know, I'll just kind of leave those that haven't been involved in suspense that very soon you should see some guidance come out, and that's gonna give us a way to do that. And it's going to come out, you know, and we're going to do it on a trial basis. And so we will have a way to do that that we're going to try out. I think it's pretty clever. I think it's going to work. I've used it on one of my projects already, and the project team really liked it. But, you know, I'm not going to give it away. It's not my baby.
Yep. Well, and one of the reasons that I wanted to ask that question is it ties back to an earlier question that someone had submitted about whether there was guidance coming out on acceptable risk and all of that. And so, yeah, you answered perfectly that a methodology is being worked on. So stay tuned for all of that for some future tools to be able to help with that. Let's see, another question that we have here is to clarify, you know, how's the detection limit, how's that determined?
So I want to see that determined in the RI, or if not in the RI, you know, prior to the remedial action. Ideally, it's in the RI, and we're going to, I mean, there are some published values, but we don't want to use those. We want to have some site-specific data that show where we can determine what that is. So that's going to be a project specific determination, at least in my vision.
Okay.
We're going to run a test.
Okay. And here's one now. Can you talk a little bit about the relationship, if any, between the MECHA tool and defining an acceptable end state?
Yeah, I can talk about that, and I can say that there's no real relationship that I see. The MECHA has some value where I think it's helpful is to compare one alternative versus the other. So it's relative to what you might achieve doing one thing versus doing something else. But where it kind of fails, is getting to that acceptable end state, or even it definitely, I think, kind of fails in performing the baseline risk assessment, where we even know if we have an unacceptable risk that we need to deal with from the get-go. So, that's one of the reasons that the methodology that we discussed earlier is coming out, is to kind of take some of those concepts from the MECHA and take some things that we've learned over the years and move forward.
Yep, very good. I agree with what you said there. I thought you said it very, very nicely. Okay, here's another one. So when you showed the remedial action, the post remedy data assessment, and you talked about wanting the advanced classification and had the scenario with the 100% UXO recovery. Can you build the same type of vertical model using MAG and FLAG or an EM61?
Theoretically, yes, but it's going to be a lot harder to defend. I think you're going to have a lot more uncertainty. If you had the QC built into it, and that's one of the real advantages with regards to classification is just the rigorous QC and of course when the accreditation program is in full effect starting in January, so we've got a lot more rigorous quality control elements. But there could be I wouldn't make the case for MAG and FLAG. I don't think it's reliable enough to make that case. With the 61, you're going to be doing a lot of digs, but I think if you did basically sanitize the site and you plotted that profile and it was well within your detection limit, then yeah, I think you could make the same argument.
Okay. The bottom line is that you can build that type of vertical CSM, or I guess we should say the actual site model. You can build that same sort of profile, but in lieu of using advanced classification with the other tools, you're just going to have a lot more uncertainty in the end product.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it.
Yep. Okay. Let's see here.
One other point that I would add too. Of course, the advantage and one of the fundamental differences with regards to classification is we know what we're leaving behind. We've classified everything, so we don't not only know what we dug up, but we've got a really good idea of what we're leaving behind, which is something that we just don't have with the older technologies.
Right. Yeah, that's a good point. Okay. Let's see, I'm going to, and I'm kind of segueing now into our open Q&A session, so I'm going to open it up to some of the questions that were submitted for our other speakers. So this first one that coming up was actually tied back to John's and Greg's presentation. So, and on that, and I'm pretty sure that it was John that had this in his presentation, but you talked about the 200 digs for the validation and verification digs. So why 200? Why is that the magic number? Wouldn't it Would it make more sense to make it proportional to the total number of digs?
I did not come up with the 200 number, but I was told by the people who did that they talked about a bunch of different numbers, and that was the one everybody seemed to agree with. If you've got a really big site, I'm sure you could go over that. And it's kind of a PDT determined thing. I mean, if somebody's really adamant that you're going to have 100,000 targets, you're going to classify the 200 is probably not going to be enough validation or verification digs. But that's kind of the base number you start from, and it was just a number that the people who came up with the AGC CLAP template came up with, and that everybody on the working group for that document seemed to agree to for a pretty standard site.
Okay. Yeah, and you're right. I guess, yeah, kind of what I was looking for, and you said it was that it really is kind of a project determination, the PDT, and it boils down to, just like we were talking about a few minutes ago, of what level of uncertainty or certainty, you know, confidence that the PDT wants to have relative to their quality assurance measures for the project. So, okay, very good. Let's see, another one here for John and Greg is, how much consideration would you place on the potential of clutter masking the targets of interest?
It really depends on how much clutter there is, but the sensors are specifically designed to look for multiple objects underground. You run through modeling with the assumption that there's only one thing where you collected queue data, and then you run through a multi-target solution, our model, where it assumes, at least in the case of UX Analyze, it runs through seven different models of what could be under the ground given the received signal. So if you have a 37 millimeter buried under a piece of scrap clutter, it is supposed to account for that. And, you know, in the projects we worked on, it has worked really well. You can really differentiate multiple sources under the same. I mean, in the end, the metal mapper sensor, which is what we've used most of the time, is a meter wide. So you're really covering a bunch of ground. It's a square meter of data every time you collect a cued point with that. So you can often cover a bunch of sources, and it separates those out pretty well.
Okay. Here's a question that was submitted before Nick's presentation, and I think Nick did a good job of covering this, but I'll throw it out there anyway. And I'll kind of provide my answer, but then I'll throw it to Nick or John or Greg, either of you that want to talk about it. And John or Greg, this question came in during your material. But the question was, you know, have you ever encountered the problem of mech being below the depth that can be detected by the equipment? And I guess, again, my answer is, that potentially could be an issue based upon your conceptual site model, but it boils down to your acceptable end state and what your acceptable or unacceptable risk is, and the land use. You know, all of those tie together, and so it's going to be on a project by project basis of what needs to be done about that. But if that's really an unacceptable risk, that there may be munitions below your equipment detection depth, then you're going to have to look at something else. You're going to have to do, you know, removing lifts or whatever it is. So, but I'm going to throw it to Nick, John, Greg. Do y'all want to elaborate on that anymore about mech possibly being below the detection depth of the instrumentation?
Well, I'll let John or Greg, if you guys have any project-specific examples, if you ask you guys that first.
I mean, it is what it is. If you know there's mech below your detection depth, that's really your options. Either you say, look, I can't guarantee that we're going to detect these things at this depth, and you know, you go along with that risk, or you're going to have to remove dirt to the point where the things are at or above your detection depth. there's not much we can do about it if you can't, if it's never going to show up in the response for a sensor.
Yeah, I agree. I would only add to that that if you've established a detection depth for a specific munition and a specific technology at the RI, or maybe you had to wait till you were doing the remedial design, you'll have a pretty good idea of what you can accomplish. I would also add that as part of another project, not actually a removal project, but we've done a lot of data mining where we've gone back and looked at tons of these removal and remedial actions that we've done in the past, and it's pretty consistently in that top 12 inches. You know, 24 inches is getting pretty deep. Now, like everything, there's exceptions. You know, it depends on how it got there. If it's discarded military munitions we're looking for and somebody dug a hole, then, you know, all bets are off. But if we're talking about things getting there from being fired downrange, it's, for the most part, it's going to be in that top 12 inches, 24 at the most.
Just one other thing. If you're thinking about classification specifically, it is possible, and we saw this on one of our earlier projects at Camp Cyber, that you can detect things at significantly deeper depths in a dynamic survey than you can classify them, at least depending on what the thing is. We were looking for 4.2-inch mortars at Cyber, and you could barely detect them to the expected depth of detection with a 61, which I think was 46 inches. They just showed up above our threshold. But we knew you couldn't classify them any deeper to that depth. So if there was anything that showed up and we picked as a target in the M61 data and the classification came back as looking like background, which essentially meant that it either was a model of geologic response, or it was something really deep that the metal mapper just wasn't classifying accurately because it wasn't getting enough signal for it, we marked that as a dig and dug it.
Okay, just a couple more questions. We're running a little bit over time here, and I want to wrap it up here in just a second, but we do have a couple more questions. And this one, what y'all were just saying, kind of ties into this next question. But and it came in, it's specifically addressed to Greg, but again, I think it ties into, Nick, what you were, the material in your presentation also. But it's for, you know, in considering the land use depth, you know, would you factor in that different, you know, receptors are likely to have different depth limits. For example, you know, residential development, you know, the utilities may be down to, they may need to go to 10 feet, you know, but the builder may dig basements to 8 feet. But a landowner, you know, they're only going to typically dig to 2 feet. So, again, I think it ties into the discussion on that last question, but I'll see if y'all want to elaborate on it anymore.
I'll take a shot at it. I would go with the deepest one. You know, and if you got somebody that's going down to, you know, a deeper depth than somebody else, you know, that's the one you want. Like I mentioned, I think the land use depth is where you build your conservatism in. But of course, when we're talking about developing a remedial action objective, we also got to consider the depth of contamination. So, you know, if they're digging to 10 feet for swimming pools, but everything's in the top 2 feet, you know, I'm not really too concerned with that area from 2 to 10 because there's no source.
Okay. Yep, I agree. Did Greg or John, did I interrupt you? Did you have something you wanted to add?
No, that sounds reasonable, Dwayne.
Okay. I got one question here, and then we'll need to wrap it up. We are running a little bit over, and I think we've plowed through almost all of the questions. And this is for Jeff from the regulator perspective there. Do you have any thoughts from your perspective on, you know, manufacturing or disposal areas?
Manufacturing and disposal areas in terms of
munitions cleanup?
Yeah, I mean, the question's a little bit broad, but yeah, you know, instead of target areas or usage areas, you know, do you have any thoughts or experience, anything that you'd like to share relative to munitions, you know, manufacturing facilities or disposal areas that you'd like
to know? We've had to work on the Rocky Mountain Arsenal here in Colorado, as well as some disposal trenches at Pueblo Chemical Depot. I would say that the scoping and the design of the investigation is completely different, because you are looking for specific sources of contamination, either being things that fell off the conveyor belt in the building, or that went out the back door instead of the front door, or things that ended up in disposal trenches or OBOD areas. So it's a completely different mindset to investigate an area like that.
Okay. Very good. Just a completely different conceptual site model fundamentally that you have to work with. Okay, I'll tell you what, we've run a little bit over on time, which I, in the past, have assiduously tried to avoid doing, so I think we're going to wrap it up. And again, I think that we really got to all of the questions that I see in the queue here, so I'm going to go ahead and wrap it up. I wanted to say just a few closing things. First, a huge thank you to our speakers. Some of the speakers today are repeat offenders. They are true M2S2 webinar warriors. They've been speakers in previous sessions. And there's a lot of work that goes into doing one of these, and it is greatly appreciated. Very, very much appreciate all putting the effort into that. And then I also have to say a huge thank you to John Sykes. He's kind of, throughout all of these webinars, he's been my partner back at the mothership, helping me plow through the questions and get everything squared away and getting them all organized. And Jean Ballant, you know, can't say enough about Jean's support on these webinars. She is just terrific, terrific at driving this particular bus. And I want to say a huge thank you to the audience. For those of you, thank you for your time. Hopefully these have been productive and useful. And, you know, without you, we wouldn't have the webinar series. So tune in next year. We are planning on having those. And last thing I'd like to say is, you know, happy Halloween to everybody. I believe it's time for some pumpkin ale. And this is Dwayne Ford signing off on the M2S2 webinars. Jean, I'll let you tell us the attendance and conclude the session for.
All right. Thank you so very much, Dwayne. I also want to echo the repeated words of praise for you, and just thanks for all of the excellent leadership you've provided over the M2S2 series over the past few years. I hope that the remainder of the audience online can also echo those congratulations. Feel free to send in a quick message to Dwayne into the Q&A. It's been wonderful working with you, and I wish you much luck in your retirement. We had nearly 180 individuals join us online. That number continues to creep up as a few of the people send in their status updates to me. We had participants from all over the country join us for today's broadcast, so I want to thank you all for organizing, and thank you, those of you who joined us out there virtually, for today's broadcast. Before we close things out today, I'd like to provide just a few final reminders. You can certainly visit us at the Cleanup Information Network at cluin.org, or visit us on the following Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn pages if you'd like to stay connected with us and learn about similar online training opportunities as soon as they become available. We are offering certificates for participating in today's webinar. If you'd like to receive one of these certificates, please follow the link that I've included in both the Q&A box and the related URLs pod on the middle or lower right of your screen. If you fill out that online feedback form, there's a box at the bottom of the form you can check, and as long as you check that box, you will immediately receive an online participation feedback form that you can either save, print. We'll also email you a copy as an attachment. We are basically instituting this across all of our webinars now, but we still continue to welcome your feedback on these certificates. They are not necessarily the same thing as CEUs or PDHs, but many of you have indicated that these are helpful in documenting your attendance and keeping records. So if you need additional help in documenting your participation, please feel free to contact me directly at ballot.gene@epa.gov. You can also continue to provide feedback. If you're watching the recorded version of today's webinar, you can still get to those links and print out one of those certificates. If you're looking for copies of the presentation materials, we have those available to download as related resources or seminar links. As noted earlier, we do have contact information for many of our instructors and organizers. Unfortunately, Duane's contact information won't be valid soon, but we do have a number of other partners who are listed there. You can certainly reach out to us if you have follow-on questions. One last final plea, please fill out that online feedback form to help us continue to offer these types of online training sessions. And again, many thanks to Duane for all of his help over the M2S2 series here on the past few years. Today's session was recorded, and you will automatically receive an email from us as soon as that archive is available. It usually takes us about 1 to 2 weeks, so please keep your eyes peeled for that email. With that, I'd like to formally conclude today's live broadcast. Thank you all so very much for joining us today.